The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Let's begin by singing together the song, the chorus we sometimes sing, "He has shown thee, O man, what is good."
He has shown thee, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of thee? But to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God. To be like Jesus, to be like Jesus, all I ask, to be like Him. All through life's journey, from earth to glory, all I ask, to be like Him.
I really appreciated the emphasis that we have heard this weekend on the concept of following Christ and being like Jesus. And it really is true that, in fact, if this school does not produce people who are like Jesus, I don't really care if we produce doctors or lawyers or anything else. It hasn't amounted to anything. In fact, it's been detrimental. So I pray that indeed this institution will be able to have people walk in the doors who are like Jesus, and have people walk out of the doors who are more like Jesus. And if we fail in this, then we have failed. Well, I am supposed to address problems and solutions in Christian education. And it seems to me that perhaps we have enough problems without me attempting yet this morning to dredge up a few more. But nevertheless, I have a list here of problems. I have these problems listed, and then under those a few points, and then I have the word solution. And I will confess to you that in a couple of places under where it says solution, I don't have much there. I don't know that I have all the solutions. I know I do not have all the solutions to all of the problems. And so if I disappoint you this morning by not giving you a lot of solutions, well, come to Faith Builders and we'll work on them together. Okay, I think I have a series of a listing of 8 problems that I would like to address this morning. These are not all of them, but I tried to pick up the ones that I hear talk about the most. And so I think what I'll do is just simply take them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 to talk about them a bit. The first problem that I find in Christian education is the problem of relationships that exist there. Now, in schools, you have relationships that are very, very intense. They're close just by virtue of the way schools are. You have the teacher and the student. You have the teacher and the parent. You have teachers and teachers. You have teachers as board members. You have the school and the church. Lots and lots and lots of nuances of relationships that exist in a school. And if you cannot somehow have those relationships working in some kind of harmony, you can't do what you want to do. The school will never produce what it is intended to produce unless those relationships work. I'm not going to begin to address all of the problems that rise up in those relationships. You know what they are. I do want to say one thing about it. I get a little weary of hearing that the problem is just personality. I have heard that so long for the past number of years. It's personality clash, or it's just personality. Oh, no, it isn't. It is true that there are differences in personalities. I will never deny that. And it is true that it takes some doing to be able to accept other people's personalities and so on. But it is not true that the basic problem in relationships is personality. Now, I will never accept that. Never. The basic problem in relationships is unholiness and ungodliness and no love and envy and strife and hatred and things like that. That is the problem. It is not personality. And I will never accept that. The song that we just got done singing perhaps touches on the solution to this. I'll give you 3 points that I think I have found in my teaching career, in my years of relating to other people, have stood me in good stead to remember these 3 things always. It comes from Micah 6:8. He has shown thee, O man, what is good. And what doth the Lord require thee? But to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God. To all teachers and to anybody who's trying to relate to anybody else, I will give you what I consider to be the most important and fundamental rule that must be held if you want to build long-lasting relationships that are productive. The first one, instead of using the word justly, I'll use the word fairness. Fairness. I have found that you can do almost anything with a student if they know something right to begin with, and that is that you will be fair. The Bible calls this doing justly. If they know in the end, when the chips are down, if you were wrong, you'll say, I was wrong. If you were right, and it's going to hurt them a little bit because you were right, you say, I was right. And this has to be this way. But they know that you're fair. All you have to do for a group of students is let them know that you're unfair and you're in trouble. The relationship is on the rocks. Okay, you're going to have difficulty getting your way through it. Number one, be fair. And if you want to use the word justice in here, you can tuck it in. Problem is, sometimes justice gets difficult. That brings the second principle that comes out of this verse. Do justly, love mercy. And notice it says, love mercy. And your students and the people around you will soon discover if, in fact, in your relationships, you love to be merciful. You need to communicate to your students, whoever it is, when you call them into your office, that I'm on your side. I'm going to do for you whatever I can do. If it means I have to paddle you, that's what I'll do. If it means that I have to let you off the hook, that's what I'll do. But I love mercy. I will do justly. I love mercy. And third, humility. Walk humbly with thy God. And if you walk humbly with your God, you will walk humbly with your fellow man. That's the solution I have for relationships. Be fair, be merciful, be humble. It comes from Micah 6:8. My testimony is, it works. It works. The second problem that I would like to suggest to you this morning that I see in Christian schools is the problem of resources. Some of these are very practical, and yet they have implications that go beyond the practical. So here's the problem. Milo, are you listening? No money, no teachers, no personnel. We don't have the resources to do what needs to be done. What is the solution to this problem? Well, there are a couple of solutions to this problem. The one is, you can beg for more. I mean, you can just say, I need money. I'm going to start doing whatever you have to do to get the money. And I don't want to be simplistic about this. I realize quite well that it takes money to make things go. But the practice of my life has had a different solution to this. Resources can be gained another way. And this I learned from my father. My father has an 8th grade education. My father is very intelligent, and he taught me many very important things. This is one of them. Make do with what you've got. That solves your resource problem. My brothers and I used to say that my father could fix more things with a pair of pliers and a piece of wire off the old fence that was falling down than most any mechanic I've ever known. He'd just go over there, snap it off, come back, and wire the baler together, and somehow we'd get the job done. You make do with what you've got. And I see this actually as a very powerful thing. I don't see it negatively at all. I see it as a great experience. A great adventure. My wife, I've taught school for 14 years, and I think it's not any secret that most school teachers don't get paid, Christian school teachers, don't get paid a great amount of money, and I'm in that class. I enjoy it. My wife and I have had a great adventure just stretching the dollars and watch God meet our needs and do all of the things that need to be done. In fact, I think it might be a mistake if, in fact, we begin to say, let's pay our teachers scale. I mean, let's get them $35,000. What kind of people are we going to get in these classrooms then? What's going to happen in the long run? I would just as well see these schools be the kinds of places that students come to, and the resources are short. The money is not flowing. And people have to get on their knees to see this thing work. And people have to go into the closet when they're going to do this science demonstration, and there aren't test tubes, and there aren't microscopes, and there aren't a lot of other things, and begin to yank those things out of the closet and come out and say, look, students, you could find these in your own kitchen cupboard. And this is the way you could do it. Much better. Well, what are you teaching then? Now you're teaching something. Now you're getting somewhere. But if you're doing something in an institution that they couldn't possibly do anyway, what's the point? You're just spinning wheels. So I'm just saying, look, on this issue of resources, the best solution to it is to make do with what you've got. Not to take some other approach. That's the wisdom of the ages. That's the wisdom of my father. That's the wisdom of Scripture. Make do with what you've got. So the problem of resources, I think, is manufactured generally. The third problem that I would like to suggest to you that we find in Christian schools is the problem of mediocrity. You remember the Laodicean church? They were neither cold nor hot. Mediocre. God said, I cannot stand it. I absolutely cannot stand it. And I'll have you know, anybody who comes to this institution, I cannot stand mediocrity. I don't mean that I want everybody to have IQs of 140 and 145. When I say that I can't stand mediocrity, I cannot stand people who will not give it all they've got. I don't care if they're classified as what people call mentally retarded. That makes no difference to me. Just show me a person who will give me everything they've got, give God everything they've got, and everything they set their hand to do, they'll do with all the strength and the energy they have, and we will not have mediocre schools. That'll change. See? Mediocrity is no good. What is the solution to mediocrity? Well, I can tell you right now, in schools in general, the solution rests in the teachers who are there, who demonstrate academically, yes, who demonstrate by their own drive and by their own way, the way in which they do things, that you don't do things halfway. You do them right. And you work at it. And you put energy into it. I think, Brother John Swartz, even though we have CLE curriculum and all that, that's great. In the end, mediocrity is somehow dispelled by the teacher, whether he's teaching in that individualized class or where he is, that teacher who's got that drive and who demonstrates that it's done right with few resources, but it's done right. The walls don't have to be perfect, but the floor should be kept clean, things should be kept in order, and things get done. We will not have mediocrity. We will do it right. We will not be lukewarm, and preferably we'll be hot for God. A fourth problem that I see in our Christian schools I'd like to bring to your attention is meeting the needs of the learning disabled. As the years have gone by, I have grown more and more concerned about this. Somebody said here this weekend that your success as a teacher is not determined by the best students you have, but how much progress has been made by the poorest student that you have. And so you have this problem of learning disabled people, dyslexia, auditory memory problems, and other things of that nature that you hear being talked about. And you wonder, what should we do? I'll be frank with you. Occasionally, somebody will call us at our school and talk about this, and I have to tell them, we do not have a program here that will particularly meet the need of your child. And I'll just be upfront with you and tell you, there's no point in sending your child here. We do not have the people who are trained to take care of this problem and so on. So you might say the problem is lack of training, it's lack of resources. I wonder if it might not be lack of interest. I mean, just let him go. You can't help him anyway. And I think sometimes it's nothing more than improper analysis. I have seen people, students, who have been diagnosed dyslexic, and they weren't dyslexic at all. There were other problems involved. A story I would like to tell you this morning that demonstrates this very clearly. We had a family in our home community who very graciously and very nicely and very kindly and in a very godly manner has taken foster children into their home over the years. And a few of those children came to our school. And I remember distinctly one of them who had been, his mother was an alcoholic, and she had some extreme problems and abused this child severely. And this mother took this family took this young man on and asked if he could be sent to our school. Well, there's more to the story than that, actually. When the papers came through on this child, they said that he is severely mentally retarded. He's a mental case. He needs to go to Philadelphia. He needs to there be examined. We really are thinking he needs to go into a mental institution. The mother in that home took a look at that analysis and evaluated this boy for about a week and said, it's not true. Would you folks at Anchor Christian School be interested in taking this child on? We said, we'll try anything. So the youngster came, and listen, we had problems. I mean, it was a difficult deal. He knew nothing about discipline. As soon as any pressure was put on, he would just wheel up and sort of fall on the floor. He had temper tantrums, a lot of things like that, and I won't go into any details, but there were times I got severe with him, and there were times that his first grade teacher got severe with him, and the boy learned to read, and he learned to write, and he learned to talk with normalcy, and he grew up to be a very nice young man. In fact, one day about a year ago, I think, we were down visiting this family, and I was sitting there on the sofa, and this little boy came over, and he hesitated just a little bit. Now, I've been rough with him a few times. He came over, and he sat down, never said a word, just sat down, leaned his head over my shoulder, and went to sleep. I won that one. I wonder how many I've lost. Just in case you think I'm pulling that out of my hat. He's here. It's Kirk back there. There you go. I did not design this speech for that. I didn't know he was coming. Just happened to be they dropped in on us last night at midnight, so I asked his mom if it'd be okay if I shared that story anyway. Okay, learning disabled. Let's not give up on him. Let's not give up on him. Let's analyze him properly. See, if we would have accepted that analysis, what would have happened? He wouldn't be here. Okay? Let's analyze properly. Let's do take the time and the resources to get the training that we need for this. To pick up the resources that we need, and let's get some interest in it. Let's learn to love taking these people who are down and out of the way, and lift them up, as the Bible says, and stand under them. That's what we need to do. Our schools need to learn how to do that. Number five. I see in our schools a lack of discipline. I do not mean necessarily just a lack of spankings. That's not what I'm talking about. There's sometimes that case too. Okay, but generally, we see a lack of a disciplined approach to things, lack of control. There's a lot of problems across the Christian school movement like this, and I've wondered about it. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact we think that these schools can be run like churches, or they're Sunday schools, or something like that. Well, they're not. The solution to this problem, I would insist, as an administrator in a school, to have the right to expel, with board approval, even if it's a bishop's son. I would insist on the right to paddle that child if I needed to, with the proper approval. I would make sure that it was understood there will be order in this school. and I would have a firm determination to carry it out. I would keep the rules few, but I would insist on those few. And you can have order in your classes, and you can have order in your schools. Do those things, and I'm telling you, you can have control in your classroom. Don't be afraid. Don't be fearful. Don't be intimidated. Walk into the situation and do what needs to be done. I would say perhaps the most important one is few roles, but consistently carry them out. And you will have control in your school. Discipline in the other sense, and that is just a good, sturdy approach to life, that we work hard, we are not lazy. All of those things are involved in this business of a proper concept of discipline. And again, a teacher must lead in this. No student is going to think in terms of doing 2 hours of homework. If they know that you come to class consistently, you don't know what you're talking about, you haven't studied the lesson, you haven't bothered yourself with it, they're not going to follow you. Well, yes, they will. They'll follow you all right, but they're not going to be the kind of person you want or the kind of student that you want. You've got to lead in this matter of discipline. That's number five. Number six, this is a problem that comes up consistently. Anytime you open up questions to school teachers, they'll almost always ask this one. What do you do to motivate a child? Lack of motivation is a problem that we find in schools. I heard it discussed a little bit this morning already. Not this morning, but yesterday. This lack of drive and motivation. What is the solution to this? I'm going to pick that up in the next point. I didn't know whether to divide these or not, but I did. Point number seven is, I know I did not answer the one on motivation, but I will here in just a moment. Point number seven is this. A lack of vision in our schools is a very, very big problem. Let me explain to you why I think there's a lack of vision. If you go back to the 1960s, and in some cases before the 1960s, you would find that the conservative Christian school movement getting off the ground and going. And some of your schools probably were not started until the 70s and maybe even the 80s and so on. What was the purpose behind almost all of those schools? As a general rule, if you sat down and listened to what the board and what the people were saying, it was this idea of preserving. It was the notion that we're losing our young people and we have to keep them. It's not a bad notion. Don't misunderstand me. I understand it perfectly. That was, at least in our community, that was certainly the idea. We're losing. We're losing ground. We're losing our young people. Yes, there were cases like evolution and so forth, but in general, I sense kind of a panic. We've got to keep these people, and we do. And so we built schools. It was a good vision, but it's not enough. I come along, and I was a young man at that time. And so by the time that I become a school teacher, I notice already there's fire gone out of the school meetings. There's drive gone out of the people who are involved in the schools. And I think to myself, what's going on? Well, if you go back and check the 70s, you'll find out what happened. There were lots and lots of splits over that time. They generally were conservative-liberal splits. And by and large, the argument was done and over with. I mean, the splits had been made. There were people who got on their tracks, whatever they wanted to, whatever brand of conservatism they wanted to have and that type of thing. And so now you couldn't say to the school teacher, your job is to save this thing from apostasy. You couldn't, it wasn't as solid anymore. And besides that, there's a bigger problem. What's the school about? It's inquiry. It's looking over the horizon. It's looking beyond. It's looking deeper into issues and into situations. And somehow that became then a tension in our schools, it seemed to me. While the schools are supposed to preserve, and schools are supposed to be schools, yet they were strapped on the issue of inquiry and moving forward and looking into other areas and this type of thing, and it stagnated us, created a problem. We need a little more vision in all of this for our schools. Some of you are at Berea, I know. If you don't mind me repeating something, I'd like for you to turn to the book of Hebrews and notice here a solution, I think, to this problem and to the problem of motivation. In fact, these particular verses, I think, do address the problem of motivation in general. Hebrews chapter 11, I would like to read to you verses 13 and 14. This, of course, is a faith chapter, and we have in focus a number of people who precede these verses. Noah, Sarah, Abraham, and so on. And it says this about them. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. They had vision. That's what that is. And were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And I'll leave off reading there. You know the passage. What do you see in these verses? What was it that was so distinctive about these people that are held in such high regard in Scripture and in history? Well, you find it right here. Number one, they died in faith, not having received the promises, but they had vision. They saw them as clearly as if they had already happened. What do you see in this place? Walls and windows and curtains, and if you walk outside, you see a conglomeration of bits and pieces of a skull that have been engineered in such a way that it would cause any civil engineer to turn over in his grave. Is that what you see? Well, I see that, yes. But what do you see in this skull? I can tell you right now, unless there are people in this skull who can see beyond all of that, who can begin to see the masses of humanity in Russia and in Australia and in Iran and beside Saddam Hussein and all those kinds of places, unless they have that kind of vision, our schools will begin to stagnate. There just won't be any drive. I mean, you've got to... Why doesn't a student want to study algebra? Well, he doesn't know what he's doing it for, oft times. Why should a person go to school if he does not have... If somebody is not projecting a vision that says this is why you're here. Now, I know not everybody will pick it up, but you can eventually build a consensus around a vision. This is what we're doing. We are training people for God, for these fields of service all across the country, rather than just trying to preserve the status quo. If we just try to preserve the status quo, we're going to drown. But if we somehow or another can project the vision that there is work that needs to be done, and faith builders as well as other schools have doors open for that reason, and that reason alone, then we'll get somewhere. Vision we need. Let's go on in these verses. But having seen them afar off, and now notice this, they were persuaded of them. They had conviction. They not only had vision, but they had conviction. And I don't have to tell you, there's a horrible lack of conviction in our day. I think I wrote to the senior class one year that in my mind, as I saw the senior class, they were fine people. They were great people. The only problem I saw was there was a tremendous lack of conviction. There was not fire in their eyes. And there was not strength in their step. They needed that. Why was there no conviction? Well, I shouldn't. Look, I'm not really talking about that group of people, but where conviction lacks, why does it lack? Because there's no vision. You have vision first, and then people build a conviction that this needs to be done. And so you have a young person, a group of people, and somebody stands up and inspires them, and they set in their heart, somebody like J. Hudson Taylor, they're going to China. And they have no idea how they're going to get there, anything like that, but that grows into a conviction in their heart. And by, you open a book and you read a story about a J. Hudson Taylor, and your heart's inspired, and you say, how did this happen? Why do we have people like this? No vision. Well, it's not going to happen. They were persuaded of them, and they embraced them. They were motivated. They got a hold of them. They grabbed a hold. Okay? They had vision. They had conviction. Then they had motivation. Now, you can't short-circuit this. See, what I have got, I have seen that teachers, schools, ministers have gotten the idea that you can somehow just talk motivation into people. Oh, no, you can't. Oh, no, you can't. It's not something that's just produced like that. But if you will produce vision, and if you will generate conviction by your own personal example and so forth, you will have an automatic motivation. And it'll solve another problem that you see here. And they confess
that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Have you heard ministers just working and working and working to try to keep their people with this stranger and pilgrim notion? I have. And again, I repeat to you, it's impossible to do that unless you take these first steps. You must build vision, then conviction, then motivation, then you'll have this. I label this one identity. These people know who they are. Late 60s and early 70s, those were the days. You folks will remember when we had riots and mobs, and my generation was rebelling against the status quo and all that kind of stuff. And I had friends who went out to find out who they were. They said they were going to California. I said, what are you going to California for? Find out who I am. These folks know who they are. They've got identity. See? No question. They're strangers and pilgrims on the earth. But I will repeat, you can't short-circuit it. You must first build vision. You must build conviction. You must build motivation. And then you will have this identity, and all of these things will begin to work. Schools will not, in the end, produce anything unless they do this. So I repeat, a problem is a lack of vision, and the solution is to begin to build vision. We don't have time this morning to begin to look into all the details of how that's done. But again, it begins by looking at godly examples of men who have done this, women who have done this. And then one begins to catch the vision of how it is actually done and sets out to do it. That is the solution. Number 8, and the last one I have here. The problem that I see in a lot of schools that I get into when I'm speaking or talking to teachers is a problem of discouragement. I won't ask you to raise your hands, but my guess is there are a number of teachers here that if I ask for a raise of hands and say, I either feel like quitting or I felt like quitting at one time. I mean, it's hopeless. How are you ever going to get anywhere? I reminded somebody last night that Winston Churchill once gave a speech in an American university. I don't remember which university it was. The speech, I think, was about exactly 5 words long. It went something like this. Never, never, never give up. Then he sat down. That was after World War II. Okay, you would have had no license to give a speech like that before World War II. Okay? Again, I repeat those same words. Don't ever give up. Now, I don't mean by that that means that you must always stay in the classroom and that if you left the classroom, that means you're giving up. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is, if I leave the classroom by God's grace, it's not going to be because I was discouraged and I just did not have the energy and the drive to keep on with it. There's some other reason. Got called into some other field somewhere. I left Anchor Christian School to come here this next year, not because I was tired of it there and couldn't stand it anymore. I left it because I felt like I should come here and teach. Don't let discouragement get you down. That's an attitude, by the way. Discouragement is an attitude. And attitudes can be dealt with. Okay? Attitudes can be combated with attitudes. Don't ever give up. Just make that up in your mind to begin with. My mother used to say about my father, well, if he said he's going to do something, he'll do it. It may take him 5 years, it may take him 10 years, but he will surely do it. It's just that simple. He won't ever give up until it's done. I remember my mother saying that a couple of times. I hope some of those genes have been passed along. I don't expect to give up. Let me read you a poem. I wrote this one in my Bible. It's not comparable to Scripture, but it's still here. Front page. It's entitled The Starfish. As the old man walked the beach at dawn, he noticed a young man ahead of him, picking up starfish and flinging them into the sea. Finally catching up with the youth, he asked him why he was doing this. The answer was that the stranded starfish would die if left until the morning sun. But the beach goes on for miles, and there are millions of starfish, countered the old man. How can your effort make any difference? The young man looked at the starfish in his hand and then threw it into the safety of the waves. It makes a difference to this one, he said.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.